In only 2 days, you can move your career further, faster with a Harvard DCE Professional and Executive Development Program. Advance your leadership skills, craft smarter business strategies, build your network, and move your career in the right direction. You'll earn a certificate of completion, add Harvard to your CV, and become the leader you want to be. Our intensive programs are designed to fit into your busy schedule. Attend online or on the Harvard campus. Search Harvard Professional and Executive Development to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, one of the hosts on the network, and today we're talking to Amy Sullivan, an independent scholar and history professor at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the author of the terrific new book, Opioid Reckoning, Love, Loss, and Redemption in the Rehab State, which was just published in 2021 by the University of Minnesota Press. Amy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Claire. Nice to be here.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I live right now in the Twin Cities, in Minneapolis in particular. But I ended up going to state schools. I went to the University of Oklahoma for my undergrad history degree and master's degree. And then after a period of several years, I then entered the University of Illinois Chicago, their Work, Race, and Gender in the Urban World program in 2004. So I had children, I had two daughters between degrees, and then finally got my PhD in 2013. Another important educational opportunity for me was attending a United World College, which was an international school that had the IB curriculum. And I think it really taught me and grounded me in the global nature of human issues and problems. And then I think your question also included mentors. I would say at the University of Oklahoma, it was Susan Laird, a philosopher of education, taught me about feminist education. I worked in the Women and Gender Studies program with her. And then at UIC, University of Illinois Chicago, I worked with Robert Johnston, who encouraged me to push the envelope with my history projects and dissertation.
And how did you come to write Opioid Reckoning?
Well, I had a very intimate and painful family experience with a heroin overdose that my child survived. And today she is a thriving woman in her late 20s. But we went through a really, really tough time. And when that happened 10 years ago, I was completely shocked to my core because I was a product of the 1980s, just say no. And I was one of those people who just said no because I was afraid. So I had really not ever experimented with substances. And so, and in particular, heroin, scared the living daylights out of me. And when I was finally able to kind of take a breath from those experiences with her, I started thinking about what how could I help? How is it that people didn't know? And, you know, then I find out, oh, there is an actual epidemic happening, and it started with prescription pills. And I also study and teach history of medicine. So it all kind of just started coming together. I also teach history of childhood and women's history. So as a mother, understanding childhood, understanding the history of mothering and medicine, it just all kind of fell right into my wheelhouse as a personal experience.
Before we dive into the book, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about the Minnesota Opioid Project, because this book is one part of a kind of larger project that you've been leading for how many years now?
Five or six. Yeah. I came up with the project initially because that was all I was going to do. I am a oral historian. I used oral histories to write my dissertation. And when this, I started, there's a very much a storytelling frame in 12-step based support groups. And I was very much drawn to that tradition. And I started thinking about how longer, long-form oral history interviews could actually, it would be really important in this moment that we were in to document some of the stories of people. Because as I started asking questions of physicians and asking questions of treatment providers, I realized there was going to have to be something significant that would have to change in order for us to not to get a handle on the opioid epidemic in particular. The original model of the abstinence only model, which I can talk about in a few minutes about the Minnesota model, it seemed like a moment where that was not going to work to help people who were addicted to opioids. And when I realized this as a historian, I'm like, oh my gosh, there's change happening. I am going to document this right now. I'm going to just start talking to people. I don't know what I'm going to do with these interviews. I don't know if anybody's ever going to read them. But here I am in the epicenter of a rehab, the history of rehab in the United States at Hazelden. I better just get some of these stories recorded. And so it was really kind of a in the moment decision. And I started with mothers because I was already familiar with a support program for moms. And mostly, I mean, dads were welcome, but it was mostly mothers who showed up all the time. So I started interviewing them. And then it just started to morph into other areas. I started thinking about, like, well, what about, you know, physicians who are promoting medication, and what about, you know, social workers, and what about people in recovery or people who had experience with opioids in their lifetime and were struggling? And so I ended up with about 50, 60 interviews. I worked with harm reduction advocates in the Twin Cities. I had no idea what harm reduction was. As I said, I was completely ignorant about all of this stuff. Ended up gathering a whole bunch of them, created an Omeka archive of harm reduction kind of ephemera and documents from the 90s. And so it's just turned into this kind of big project. So eventually I decided I'm going to name it the Minnesota Opioid Project, and had to kind of put a box around it as in terms of the state, because I soon realized that it could be really, it could just go on and on forever if I started thinking about other regions or states in general.
Minnesota is a good place to draw boundaries, though, and we'll get into addiction treatment in a minute here. But before we do, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you prepared to do this work. And in terms of preparation, I'm thinking not just of your training in oral history, but also how did you prepare to take care of yourself psychologically while you were researching and writing? This is hard work.
This is really hard work. And so just to be personal here for a moment, my dissertation was about a trauma that I also had a personal connection to, related to an event in the 1970s, around a tragedy at a Girl Scout camp where I was a camper. So I had spent, you know, a good part of my life experiencing post-traumatic stress and never being properly diagnosed. So by the time I was working on my dissertation, I had been, I understood so much more about the history of trauma. How do people, you know, heal from it? What kind of the cutting edge treatments that were interesting to me, just not as a person, but also as a historian of medicine. So I was really tuned into listening to how people spoke about things. And so one of the things that helped me immensely with the opioid project interviews, because you can imagine interviewing mothers who lost their child and their to an overdose, and their willingness to sit down and tell the story of their child's life and their struggle to help them find the kind of care they needed. These were really intense interviews. And I know enough about trauma that when I read cues in people's faces, their bodies, and always start by saying, you know, if you need to take a break at some point, we can just pause and take a break, or you don't have to talk about this or that. But what I found was more willingness to talk about things than you would normally expect. And I think it has to do because of the way that I myself showed empathy and understanding for their situation and where they were. And so there's probably more of a back and forth with my interviews than what, you know, classical oral history people might say, oh, you don't do that, or that's, you know, but this is not how I operate. And so I just decided early on that I was going to have these conversations and see where they went. So that my dissertation and my life experience prepared me for it. But I would also say that, you know, my family support group prepared me, because initially, before I was writing the book, that was a place where I could go and just feel, you know, just comforted, or keep up a kind of my own learning to just those kind of spiritual and personal, interpersonal things that those groups teach you, to just take space when you need it, take good care of yourself, take walks, read things for pleasure. Don't just always read the news or things for work. So I think self-care became a really important thing for me. I live not far from a lake here in Minneapolis. And so walking the lake near my house was also a huge just moment to kind of clear my brain when I'd had, you know, a tough interview.
And the book also, you write about that in the book too, which I found really meaningful, about how, you know, people who are living sort of crisis to crisis, you don't have the time or don't have the ability to sort of zoom out and see the bigger picture. And so, you know, having this lived experience, but then being in a position to do this more theoretical work and contemplative work, it's something that is unique that you bring to the project.
Yeah, thank you. One of the things in thinking about how, you know, the writing of the book, turning it from interviews, is it seemed really clear with the intensity of the content that it was important for me to be there as a narrator, which is really different from history, you know, the history writing. And maybe we can talk about that later or now, but it was my editor and I realized that, okay, if you continue to write this way through these chapters, you're helping us, because as readers, we need to trust that things are, we need to trust you that you're going to help us get through this content. And I think that that was something that happened along the way and in the process of writing that is also kind of a way of self-care for the actual reader.
The book absolutely does that. And I would encourage our listeners to check it out. Before we jump into the book, I want to turn our attention back to Minnesota and what the Oral History Project revealed about the state of addiction treatment in Minnesota. Zooming out, what did you find doing all of these oral histories with so many different stakeholders?
Well, what I found is that, and this may not come as a surprise to you, Claire, I just found that they were siloed from each other, that you had the Minnesota model, which is the model for drug treatment in the entire United States, almost, across the board, 90%, I would say, unless you think that I'm wrong about that. That is what people mean when they say they're going to rehab. It's the Minnesota model that prepares you to remain abstinent from all all drugs and alcohol, and to get support through the advocacy support groups, particularly AA and NA and 12-step groups, and get a sponsor and work a spiritual program. So there's that model. And then there's this, really rich community of addiction medicine physicians and people who are researching at the University of Minnesota about the brain and addiction. This is going on. They're seen completely separately from rehab. They very rarely interact with each other. And then you have the harm reduction. You have the grassroots kind of people, advocates who came out of the HIV AIDS era, who wear bloodborne diseases with people who inject drugs needed to have clean needles, and the whole kind of network, the street based person to person network that emerged in the 90s and into the 2000s that's reappearing today. So I got to see that here in Minnesota, these three silos, while they may be aware of each other, they're not. There was very little overlap when I first started interviewing people. And then as I got, a few years into the project, it became clear that there was starting to be some conversation between these different stakeholders, and that Hazelden was going to start using certain medications for opioid use disorder for people while they were there, and then possibly a little bit after. But there's still that feeling of, that medication such as methadone, Suboxone, these are things that mean that a person isn't abstinent. And so what I found was a lot of troubling, a lot of very troubling ideas that were actually keeping families and their loved ones from asking questions and demanding services that would actually help them heal. So it would just be someone would be cut off or shut out, or this person should just be on methadone and they have no other reason for a spiritual life, or there's no other reason to help that person because they've been to treatment so many times. It's just that there needs to be more overlap. And I think that's what I'm hoping, is to kind of create some bridges between, by using people's stories, so that you could say, oh, well, this doctor, Marv Seppala, who became, he was the first teenager who went to Hazelden in the 70s because he had a drug problem. Then he leaves, decides eventually he wants to be a doctor, becomes a psychiatrist, and wants to go back to Hazelden to be a psychiatrist. And when he goes back, they're like, we don't need a psychiatrist. And he's like, what? So he ends up, he's like, but I wanted to come back here and work and help people with addiction. And eventually they did hire him, and he became their chief medical officer, just retiring this past year. But I tell that story because he is the perfect example of how a person found the help that they needed, but then saw a bigger problem and went back and wanted to help, continue helping and expand this treatment model with science, with medication, and just the struggle that he had in trying to do that. So there's hope. But I was shocked when I found how kind of siloed and even stigmatizing these models are with each other.
Well, Opioid Reckoning includes chapters dedicated to oral histories from mothers of children with opioid use disorder, to addiction medicine physicians, harm reduction advocates, treatment providers like Marv, who are working to change the addiction treatment system from within. I wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit about why you chose to organize this, the stories in the book this way.
Well, I started writing the book because I was approached by an editor who saw my project on my faculty website. And I had been interviewing people, and I continued to interview people while I was still writing the book. So some of what happened is that as I started thinking about the narrative arc of the book, there were other stories that I needed to gather in order to make it, you know, have a beginning and a middle and end in a way, just thinking of it that way. But initially there were, you know, some of the chapters, as you know, are more like, you know, shorter sections that involve individual people's stories. And then others are longer narrative deep dives into the lives of people. And one is in particular is a family. And I think what I finally decided was that in order to keep the book under the, you know, page limit that it needed to be, was that there were certain stories and narrators who really exemplified things that I had found that resonated in other stories as well. There were some common themes, common experiences, and then one person's story would just kind of stand out as being like this one. And so rather than integrating all the people as if I was doing, you know, qualitative research, like, oh, this many people said this, I realized that some of the chapters just got too crowded with people. And I, you know, there were the mothering chapter took me forever because it started off for something else and then was adapted for the book. And I realized after I'd started writing the book that I needed fewer people. I didn't need as many people in the book. So it's really thinking about like the crowd of narrators. So that's just in a simple way how that turned out. But when I think in particular about the Prognosis Cloudy, the chapter about Spencer Johnson and his family, how his story just exemplified so many aspects of the current opioid epidemic, its failures, the stigma, the siloed experiences, and then unfortunately also the criminal justice system or injustice system in his story in particular, when a drug dealer in the Minneapolis area was convicted of 5 counts of third degree murder because she's the one who sold the fentanyl laced heroin to them. And this is also highly unusual. There's very few states that are doing this. So I felt that Spencer's story and his family's just reticence to have him included in this trial, that idea that justice will be served, whether, you know, the family of the deceased wants it to be or not, was really fascinating and disturbing to me on some levels when we think about, like, you know, law and order, and the war on drugs. So I, yeah, so that's a kind of a long answer that you were asking for, but yeah, that you can see that grappling with all these different stories, it became hard because there were so many powerful stories that it became really hard to kind of pick and choose and decide. But ultimately that's what I had to do.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Spencer's story is a very powerful story, and it's sort of, the book does such a wonderful job of bringing readers, you know, into the problem of the opioid epidemic, or rather using this perspective from families as a way to bring the lived experience sort of home. And also to look sort of outward and see how many people and how many areas of society the opioid epidemic sort of touches. I think Spencer's story is a really moving one. I know that you plan to have a companion website for the Minnesota Opioid Project. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. And the interviews will be up there, they'll be publicly available. What would you want to direct people's attention toward?
So there's kind of two parts to what's going to happen with the interviews. The more formal academic part is that the University of Minnesota social welfare archive or social history. Anyway, I've got the wrong name for it right now, but the University of Minnesota libraries and archives have asked to have these interviews, and they will keep them, paper copies of them. They will digitize them, and they'll digitize anything that I give them from the project, or they'll have it available in the archive. The other part of my project, I wanted to have a digital life of its own, so that people could connect with these stories, hear people's voices, and also read more annotated versions of some of the interviews, see photographs. So my plan, which got, you know, waylaid because I was writing the book, is to create an archive, an online archive for the general public that would be separate from what the University of Minnesota would do. So I'm trying to cover, you know, two bases, this digital world we live in, where people want more, access to resources. I'm hoping to also, you know, direct people to resources and things that might help them, even academic papers, scientific papers, where they could, you could just find things that would be useful if you happen to be embroiled in the struggle of a chaotic addiction with yourself or with another person. So there's that kind of helpful, interesting public site. And then the archive is where I feel my, you know, my allegiance to oral history and to having it in a proper place. Because this was originally what I thought. I was like, well, I'm just going to make this collection and deliver them to this. Surely someone will want this, whether it's, you know, the Minnesota Historical Society or the university, someone will want this information. So that's my plan, to touch all bases there.
If you could direct listeners to just one oral history interview from the project, once they're sort of, say they're digging in the archive or they're poking around on your website at some future date, what would you want? What do you think everyone should listen to?
Oh, that was such a hard question. I really think that it would be Ann Perry, Spencer Johnson's mom. Because I think I will end up having two or three interviews with her. And just, there's something about her, how she took Spencer's addiction on and helped him as best she could for as long as she could. I think 11 years is how long he lived with that, and died from an overdose. And then that experience, as I mentioned, there's really something powerful about reading the entirety of an interview. And I would say that Anne, although Marv Seppala is definitely in second place. And then I had another woman, Julie Hooker. So I'm not answering. I'm being a really good student and putting more in there than the professor has asked.
Top three. That's great.
Yeah, I was like, can we change that question, please, to the top three? Julie Hooker's story is really interesting because she started using heroin in the 80s, late 80s, and moved back to Minnesota. So she moved out west, developed an addiction, really was, you know, her story is just powerful. And then she too comes to want to change the treatment from the inside and ended up creating her own treatment center. So there's just so many powerful people with incredible stories of you know, love and giving back and resilience. I think, yeah. So anyway, now I've really exploded your question.
Well, you write in the introduction, I believe, early on in the book, you write about a kind of pattern or a cycle that emerged from the oral histories you gathered. You call it a painful, almost never-ending pattern, and that is, and I'm quoting here, stigma thrives on shame, shame thrives on fear and regret find refuge in silence, silence keeps stigma intact. This cycle is not only an internal emotional one shared by individuals and families, it is also embedded in institutions, laws, and protocols meant to help in scare quotes, people with substance use disorders. What can be done about this cycle?
I love that you pointed this out because this was one of those middle of the night moments of like, wait a second, what is happening in these interviews? What is happening? So I think what we need to do, and there are some kind of social science-y people doing this, but I think we need to do it in a humanities-based way, and that is to dissect, to use a science word, we need to dissect stigma, or we need to kind of excise it. We need to find it where it's hiding in everything and get it out of there. It's like a, you know, it is like a cancer in a way. It just, it ends up, we started off, you know, dealing with, you know, alcoholism in a very moralistic way, even though it was devastating families and communities in the, you know, the mid, after the gin craze and in the mid 1800s. And there's a moral, the deep moral dimension has imbued everything. And that moral dimension is also a judgmental one that stigmatizes people who use, and there's a very much a hierarchy of drugs and which drugs are okay. Like it's okay to drink to a certain point, but injecting drugs is another whole story. And then ideas about those people, because of where we end up seeing them, because of the stigma and because of the lack of care they're getting, we've kind of created those people, right? Who like, quote, live under a bridge, or criminals, or, you know, they're criminalized for something they're suffering with. And there's just so, I'm getting a little bit off here, but when you start to see stigma, it's like seeing gender. You can't unsee it, right? When you start seeing, you know, racism in institutions, you can't unsee it. But this has been, there are certain groups that we still will continue to stigmatize, and we feel that we're justified in judging them and dismissing them. And I think the drug users are still among those kinds of people, because so many people are incarcerated for an addiction. And people, oh, that can't be true. No, it is absolutely true. So when I start thinking about institutions and laws, there's stigma inside those very laws, right? Think about drug courts and all the people, the different kinds of judges in drug courts. Like you might see one, like there was a recent feature in the New York Times about a judge in New Mexico who's doing incredible things around trying to end the opioid epidemic. And then you'll see judges who are, you know, putting people away for 100 years in other parts of the country. So a failed UA, right? A failed urine drug screen could put somebody in jail, back in jail. When another judge would be like, okay, I'm going to give you another chance because I really, you know, I can relate to you somehow. There's not kind of, there's so much personal, we just bring so much to this problem that if we can't learn to see people with substance use disorders as human beings first, and as people who are maybe asking for help with their issue, you know, we can't end this crisis. So that's a really long answer to your question, but I really believe that the shame piece, the silence piece, the fear, and then the regret are just embedded in so many things, not just in our institutions, but in the very people who've struggled and who still want help. I received an email to my college email account from a woman in her 30s who said, the first line was, "Dear Professor Sullivan, I am an unwilling fentanyl addict. I've been trying to get help for years. I'm 33 years old. I cannot get the care that I need." And it's just been having this, you know, email exchange with her has been so validating to me in that this is not a problem just in Minnesota. This is not a problem. You know, this is the problem. You have people who really want help, who can't get the help they need because of all the barriers that are put up, but also all the individuals that they have to deal with who decide they're not, nope, you can't do it this way. She's like, I know what will work for me and no one will do this for me. She's like, this is the care I need. I can't do this part again. I can't do the detox again. I can't, here's what I need and I can't find it, which we would never do this with any other medical condition, right? We would never tell people to just go to a meeting and pray for their, if they, you know, or let's think about the ER example. You feel like you're having a heart attack. Well, we might have a bed for you in 10 days, right? But in the meantime, just go back out there, which is basically what happens when people overdose and are revived. Just get them out, treat them and street them. So this is, it's just, I guess the other thing, and I know I'm rambling here, but we're in a crisis. 100,000 people died last year. When are we going to actually make really quick, decisive moves? And this is, I think, the thing that ended up frustrating me the most was just how slowly change is happening. And I think stigma plays a big role in that.
I have a follow-up question, which is whether you would you describe your oral history project as an activist project?
It sure sounded like it from what I just said, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, I would say I am definitely an activist around this issue, a scholar activist, let's put it that way. I do, but first I think it's an education project. It's an empathy project. And then if you have empathy, you can then choose to make different choices for your loved ones and for your people in your community. So yeah, I would first call it an empathy project, because that's what I'm starting to hear from people who've read the book is, wow, I had no idea. I just had no idea. And I think that that's part of what I want, is I want to kind of open up all these doors to all these stories so that people can actually get a sense of what is it like for families, for people who use, for people who are working on, you know, street outreach, for physicians. What is it like, and how can we change this? So yes, it is activist, but that's underneath the education and the empathy.
The right. Empathy part. Secondarily.
Yes, secondarily, okay. Yeah.
What's the current state of the project? What are your hopes for it?
The current state is that I need to get my interviews ready for the archive, and I need to create my website, make my website what I imagine it to be. But I don't know, I'm not sure that I'm going to keep interviewing people. One thing I thought about doing was creating kind of an opportunity for people to interview other, you know, to have students interview people, to have people, you know, people who have learned some things, like maybe in my oral history class, students could interview other people. Collect names of people who are interested in being interviewed, or find some kind of way for stories to continue to be shared. What I've seen in my research on these kinds of websites is that this can be difficult to maintain over time. And so I really have to think about that in terms of what is this? Is this book going to, and this archive, just a snapshot in time? And I'm probably leaning in that direction because of the constant attention that a website that's constantly uploading new people's stories requires on the tech end, and the, you know, the college IT folks, or even on myself. So that's and my hope is for the project itself, and for the book, I think, is that it gets in the hands of people who can use it to share, for people to feel more open about sharing their stories, I think, is another aspect of it. But then also as an educational tool, I'd really like to see it be used in public health schools, in medical schools, in treatment centers. I'd like therapists to read it. I'd like people who work in methadone clinics. I just think there's a lot of opportunities to use it in a way that could actually benefit people who encounter the systems that people currently encounter when they're struggling with a use disorder.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I'm sure it'll be a useful book, and it's an exciting project that the book is a part
of. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We've taken up a lot of your time, and this sort of this brings us to our kind of traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next?
It's a toss up. No, I'm just kidding. It's a toss up between embroidery projects and art projects, or getting my dissertation turned into a book. I think I will work on getting my dissertation turned into a book and just keep those other little self-care creative projects on the side. In all seriousness, I would like to turn my dissertation into a book because it has, I really want to bust open the idea of true crime, the experience, the tragedy that I wrote about was a 1977 Girl Scout camp where three young girls were sexually assaulted and murdered on the very first night of camp. And because the perpetrator was found not guilty, and then subsequently died. I shouldn't call him a perpetrator, the accused. The story has become fodder for true crime aficionados, and I find it really troubling. And my dissertation tried to work on this, you know, was going in this direction, obviously, which this is not a true crime. This is a tragedy. And we need to find other ways to think about crime, because in a society that's becoming increasingly more violent, we have more and more people who are living with trauma, and we need to do something about it. And this is an even bigger project than opioids, I'm afraid, in terms of like a big project, right? But thinking of it, this project, my dissertation is a micro history, and that is, I want it to be something that isn't just a story of what happened from the perspective of survivors, which no one was called a survivor the way that people are now. We were all just told to, you know, just get on with our lives. We have so many people walking around who are survivors of violence. And it seems to me we need to like look at certain stories and figure out what are the ways that we can heal from this and create more of a, you know, less violent communities. But how can we also turn away from glorifying crime and making it such, tantalizing, titillating kind of entertainment, especially when it involves women and children. And that seems to be the bulk of true crime in so many cases. So yeah, that's a dark project.
A very worthy project. Wow. And bigger than the opioid epidemic.
Yeah. So it kind of scares me. Now you know why I wanted to talk about like art projects and embroidery.
Well, I wish you all the best of luck with it, and with the Minnesota Opioid Project too.
Thank you
so much for sharing it with our audience today,
Amy. Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you about it.